Hi, welcome to a London Miscellany podcast. My name's Steve. What I hope to do is to bring you some stories about the nation's capital that possibly you haven't heard before. For the last 10 years, I've been hosting guided tours around the city as I'm fascinated by London's history, streets, buildings, and most importantly, the people who once called the city home. While researching these tours, I always collect more information than I need, sometimes because the story doesn't fit in with the theme of the tour, or possibly there's not enough time to tell it. I feel these are too good to waste, and for the last couple of years I've been posting them on a blog, but more of that later, as I'm itching to get on with the next story. So come with me back to a London that on the surface looks very different. But with human nature being what it is, look a little closer and you'll find nothing really changes.
The Bridge of Sighs. So, you have a Bridge of Sighs in Venice. Then there's one in Oxford, and another, apparently keep up with the Joneses, in Cambridge. I counted another 12 in Europe and North America. The one I want to focus on today no longer exists, or rather it has been replaced by a newer bridge, and that is Waterloo Bridge, which spans the River Thames in the heart of London. The current bridge was officially opened in September 1942. Some 10 years after the demolition of its predecessor, and is that first bridge that was to gain the epithet the Bridge of Sighs. The original bridge was designed by Scottish civil engineer John Rennie and opened in 1817. Built out of granite, it had 9 arches, each of 120 feet, that's about 36 metres in span, each span separated by double Doric stone columns, and was 2,456 feet, about 748 metres long, including the approaches. During its construction, it was known as the Strand Bridge. However, a Parliamentary Act was passed in 1816 to name the bridge in commemoration of the Duke of Wellington's victory over Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. On the second anniversary of victory, the bridge was officially opened with a rousing ceremony. Large crowds gathered to see the ceremonial ribbon cut by the Prince Regent, who then crossed the bridge by carriage, accompanied by the Duke of York and the Duke of Wellington, to the adulation of the masses who stood at either end. The bridge was lined by veterans of the conflict that defeated Napoleon, who added to the tumult by giving 3 rousing cheers as the Prince and the 2 Dukes passed by. The Prince Regent, who was a master at jumping onto any passing bandwagon in an effort to raise his declining popularity, expressed his wonder at the project and proclaimed his desire to knight Rennie, but the Scotsman politely declined the offer. The design of the bridge gained plaudits from the media at the time, and its construction was marvelled at throughout the world. The renowned Italian sculptor Antonio Canova described Waterloo Bridge as the noblest bridge in the world. He was struck that so magnificent a structure could have been built by a private finance and not the work of a government. And therein lay the problem with the bridge. The final cost was in excess of £1 million, which included the purchase of the land and buildings and the construction of the approaches. To show a return on the investment, the bridge company levied a toll on anyone using the crossing. Right from the outset, the company were in financial difficulties and never made a profit because of the relatively small numbers of prospective customers. Those who did wish to cross the Thames to reach the sparsely populated Lambeth side used the toll-free bridges either side at Westminster and Blackfriars, and it is this scarcity of both horse-drawn and pedestrian traffic that leads us into the story of how the bridge got its moniker. During the 1840s, the bridge gained a reputation as a popular place for suicide attempts. So much so that in 1844, Thomas Hood wrote a poem which concerned the suicide of a prostitute there, which was called The Bridge of Sighs.
The bleak wind of March made her tremble and shiver, but not the dark arch or the black flowing river. Mad from life's history, glad to death's mystery, swift to be hurled anywhere, anywhere, out of the world.
It appears that Hood, having already drafted the poem in which the poor unfortunate woman drowns herself in a canal, became aware of the number of suicides jumping from the bridge, and so to contemporise his work, changed the scene to Waterloo Bridge. The artist George Watts was so moved by the piece as to paint the picture, found drowned after reading Hood's poem, and so the name of the Bridge of Sighs moved into the nation's consciousness. During the same decade, an average of 3 people a month took their own lives from Waterloo Bridge, probably because as a toll bridge it was less busy than the others and they were less likely to be disturbed. Ironically, a director of the bridge company was later to say that
the tolls surely saved many a penniless wretch from finding himself in the dark cold waters below.
In 1873, the Royal Humane Society set up a 24-hour receiving house by the northern end of the bridge, manned by a doctor who would attempt to revive any victims brought to him. And in 1875 alone, 21 people were saved by this method. However, being saved from drowning may have only been the start of your future troubles. The Thames at the time was a fetid, polluted river, described to newspapers by a Thames bargeman.
"Whoever swallows it quaffs what is impregnated with all the filth of London and Westminster, and charged with the contents of the great common sewers, which spits out a pretty particular considerable quantity of filth into the Thames. The drainings from dunghills and lay stalls, the refuse from hospitals, slaughterhouses, colour, lead and soap works, drug mills, gas works, the minerals and poisons used in mechanics and manufacture, enriched with the putrefying carcasses of dogs, cats, rats, and mixed with all the scourings of all the wash tubs and kennels within the bills of mortality."
The bridge wasn't just connected to suicide, or as the Victorians put it, self-murder. In 1857, under cover of darkness, an unknown person carrying a large carpet bag paid their one penny toll and walked halfway across the deserted bridge. Attaching a long piece of rope to the bag's handles, they lowered it from the bridge parapet into the murky waters of the Thames and then let go of the rope, allowing the current to take it downstream. But Sam Hayat got caught on one of the bridge's piers. The next morning, 2 watermen scouring the river for salvage spotted the brightly coloured bag and rowed over to investigate. After wrestling the heavy waterlogged bundle into their boat, they set about opening it, and to their shock and horror, found that it contained female body parts.
That's a right carry-on and no mistake.
3 years before Thomas Hood published his poem, the bridge was the scene of an event that was reported throughout the world. In 1841, the American daredevil and stuntman, Samuel Gilbert Scott, known to all as Scott the Diver, was touring Britain, performing feats of strength and daring stunts to large crowds. He had developed a reputation for water-based stunts during his time in the American Navy. He left the service to become a full-time stuntman and travelled to the UK, where he embarked on a tour of England, diving or jumping from great heights into shallow water. An athletic swimmer, Sam would regularly pit himself against strong tides, swimming between 2 fixed points after having run 2 or 3 miles to dive into the river to begin his swim. He also performed feats of escapology, sometimes on board ships hanging from the rigging and sometimes dangling from a scaffold erected on the bridge parapet. As the momentum of his tour increased and the crowd numbers and newspaper articles grew, it was decided that the time was right for him to bring his performance to London. Remember the Waterloo Bridge Company and their monumental investment in its building, which they were still failing to show a decent return on? Someone on the committee with an eye for such things saw the chance to host Scott's performance on the bridge, hopefully bringing much needed funds and to highlight the bridge to a mainly apathetic populace. Details were advertised in the press and by handbills that a scaffold was to be built on Waterloo Bridge, whereon Scott would entertain a paying crowd to perform feats of endurance and escapology. One part of the act that he had been wowing crowds with was for him to be trussed in a canvas bag, wrapped in chains while suspended by his feet from the topmost part of a sailing ship's rigging. He would extricate himself, loosen the bonds on his feet, and gracefully dive to the waiting waters below. Egged on by the avaricious bridge company with a view to what was hoped to be a very large paying crowd, Scott pronounced during a press conference that he had added an extra level of jeopardy and would at Waterloo Bridge perform the stunt hanging by his neck from the scaffold rather than by his feet. He decided to practice the same feat of daring some 2 weeks before the Waterloo Bridge event by hanging from the mast of an American ship that was moored at Dartford in Kent. However, the event at Dartford didn't go according to plan. It appears that through a little trickery, the noose did not actually pass around Samuel's neck, but was so tied that he suspended himself by his jaw while he worked to raise his body into a position to make the dive. Apparently, during the rehearsals, the knot in the rope slipped and closed around his neck. It was only by the quick actions of a sailor that prevented Scott from being strangled, supporting his weight long enough for Scott to loosen the rope's stranglehold. Obviously shaken, but forever the showman, Scott announced to the excited crowd, "The hemp that is to hang me has not been grown yet." It was to prove a rash claim to make. On January 11, 1841, Scott's itinerary was to run from the White Hart Public House in Drury Lane to Waterloo Bridge, a distance of around a mile, suspend himself by the neck, and once free of his bonds, dive into the river, swim ashore against the tide, perform some other stunts, then return to the pub for a celebratory drink. The event had been well publicised, as I suspect had his brush with death a fortnight before. The crowds lined the route and filled the bridge to capacity. Every vantage point was used and a small armada of boats bobbed up and down on the river itself. Around 11 that morning, Sam, fortified with several pots of ale, set off from the White Hart and ran along the route lined with excited onlookers, many of whom joined the stuntman to run behind him cheering and shouting encouragement. Arriving at the bridge, it took Scott a while to jostle his way through the scrum of people eagerly awaiting him. Theatrically, he saluted the crowd before scampering up the 30-foot-high scaffold and once at the top swung himself onto a small platform that contained the rope. Taking it up, he presented the noose to the crowd below before slipping it over his head. The assembled throng became hushed as, with the help of two assistants, Sam was lowered from the platform some 10 feet. As the lowering ropes were detached, the crowd at one gasped as the American was left hanging in midair, suspended by the rope around his neck. And here he stayed, swinging gently back and forth as the excited onlookers speculated how long it would be before he began to extricate himself. However, he remained inert for a long time. Once again, the knot in the noose had slipped and tightened around his neck. As has also happened in Deptford, the spectators mistakenly thought that this was all part of the act, and no immediate action was taken. Eventually, one man in the crowd demanded that Scott be cut down and came to his aid, but tragically, it was too late. A medical journal written some years later states that Scott was left hanging for 13 minutes before any action was taken. Newspapers had a field day, rushing to get reports of the accident out on the streets, trumpeting dramatic headlines. Reports say that Scott was immediately taken to Charing Cross Hospital, where every attention was paid to him, but unfortunately without effect, as life was quite extinct. The writer Thomas Carlyle wrote about the accident a couple of days after. "A wretched mortal that was wont to leap from topmasts, bridges and dive and do feats of that kind, perished in a shocking manner, as you will see by that newspaper, here this week. One of his tricks was to act hanging. The noose slipped. He was found hanged in earnest. When I think of the mob looking at him, brutal animals, and those still more brutal gentlemen of the bridge committee encouraging such a scene, few things I have ever heard have seemed more detestable. And as for those brutal gentlemen of the bridge committee, they never again staged such an event. The bridge limped on, and even the advent of the omnibus didn't help them, because although laden with passengers and demanding a toll in excess of that of the horse-drawn carriages, the bus companies simply routed their vehicles to use the free bridges to cross the Thames. By 1878, things had become untenable for the company, and Waterloo Bridge was purchased by the Metropolitan Board of Works for £475,000, leaving some of those brutal gentlemen well out of pocket. The bridge became toll-free, and within weeks, traffic across it steadily increased. This was the bridge's undoing, as designed for horse-drawn traffic, it failed to cope with the heavier vehicles, and by the turn of the century, the repair costs started to spiral. Serious movement in both of the piers and the span were observed in 1923, so in 1926 the London County Council decided to replace the bridge. It was demolished in 1934 and eventually replaced with the current crossing. So next time you walk across Waterloo Bridge, spare a thought for those poor troubled souls who ended their own lives there, and for the daredevil American stuntman, who you could say was hoisted by his own petard.
You've been listening to a London Miscellany podcast, which was written and produced by me, Steve Matthews. You can find more stories and information about the tours that I host by visiting www.alondonmiscellany.com. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to check out other episodes. Goodbye.